Welcome to Flyover Conservative Podcast with David and Stacey Whited, where we break down current events and examine culture through the lens of conservative Christian values. Hey, Flyover family, welcome. We are so excited to be with you. If you're new to Flyover Conservatives, our slogan is wake up, speak up, and show up. We all wanted President Trump to do 80 million things to save our country. And what we've learned over these last couple of years, what we really need is 80 million of us doing one thing every single day to save our own country.
Yep. And that's one purpose of having this studio here is to bring,
yes.
to bring in guests that are doing those one things and doing it in a great way to the best of their ability. And you kind of gain something new from every single person. And I think what that is you recognize what they're doing, and it kind of wakes something up inside of you. You learn something new. You have a new idea. You're more effective. Your axe is a little sharper on the tree that God's called you to be chopping down. And we wrestle with some of the biggest topics
we do.
Going on in the world today. And we have one of the most brilliant guests that I've ever met in my life.
You may need a dictionary, though. His vocabulary is absolutely amazing.
He's author of a book called The Dark Eon. He's a writer for The Federalist. He's a regular guest for the last 3 years on Steve Bannon's War Room, wrestling with issues there like transhumanism, artificial intelligence, the impact of that on us and the world around us. He also has a degree from Boston University as well as a background in theology. So very equipped to wrestle with these kind of topics. And so with no further ado, Mr. Joe Allen. So, Joe, you say in your book that it's never a good idea to talk about religion, politics, or robots in, you know, decent society. But, you know, I'm anxious to do that with you today.
Yeah.
we're going to break every rule.
It's actually worse than that.
We're going to dive into all of them.
Never talk about race, robots, or religion.
Oh.
I want to get into all of them because we're in an interesting space in our world today where, you know, we have children there in the late 20s and 30, 31, and then they have kids. So we're grandparents. Our parents are alive, and Stacy's grandmother is alive. She's 101. And so, we can have these conversations where there's a lot of generations. Now, our life is much similar to her grandma who's 101 as far as life experiences. Technology would change, but it's kind of slow.
And then, she used a typewriter when she was in high school. I used a typewriter when
I was an electric typewriter, but it's still the same kind of idea. You know, she won a typewriter at our senior prom.
It was a big win. It was a big deal.
Had autocorrect. It's kind of a big thing. You know, but throughout human history, you could have a child, a parent, a grandparent, and they could all maybe be in the same industry or field. If it was a farmer, they were all using a similar technology. The grandfather could actually talk to the grandson and teach him the craft and, you know, these things. And now the world around us is changing, not in over 100 years or 300. It's changing in a year. It's changing in a month. And so some of these things I want to get in with you today, and hopefully our listeners really enjoy, because they're grappling with things. My son will come to me with questions about parenting. They're like, I don't know, because I can't tell you what my dad did with me because we didn't do that with you because these things didn't exist. We're wrestling with problems that the problem didn't even exist.
How do you download the alphabet into the baby's brain?
Yeah, exactly.
It's an interesting spot. You got a book, The Dark Eon, and excited to get into it. So they say don't judge a book by its cover, but this has a really great cover. It's got a foreword by Steve Bannon, and with your history with being on the War Room and the things that you've done. I'm interested to get your perspective on these topics because we are personally wrestling with these things, and it can be fearful, it can be exciting, you know. But I guess just start from the beginning. Your background, at one point you had never heard of AI, and so
now you're writing
a book about it. So kind of walk us through that process of your awareness of this and your education with Boston University and your background. How did this kind of come onto the scene for you?
really young, for various reasons. There was never some point at which I became suspicious of the technology around me, but the earliest recognition I can remember was about age 15, and it only accelerated, as it were, from there. You know, a lot of people want some sort of rational reason as to why anyone would be freaked out by the toaster, so to speak. I don't think there necessarily has to be. In fact, I think a lot of the aversion to the rapid pace of technological development and this sort of rift in history that's being engineered as we speak, I think much of it is as aesthetic as it is rational or moral or anything like that. There's a feeling to it. And some people feel very excited about it. Some people feel very afraid. Some people just are put off by it, and some are neutral. So when I was 17, after being kicked out of high school three times, I found myself in the computer lab at my community college, surfing the internet, didn't really have a good computer at home. And I came across Ted Kaczynski's Industrial Society and Its Future. And
The Unabomber
guy.
Yeah. Okay.
You can't just breeze by, though. You get kicked out of high school three times. What happened?
I was a rowdy young man.
Just bored?
Yeah, but I was a good test taker, so I got through that GED really easy.
Okay, yep.
Well, yeah. And you're
a brilliant mind.
A cool brilliant guy. You don't dress like nerd, you know? You're kind of.
But I am.
It's a disguise.
Yeah.
You're incognito.
Yeah, but that book really did have a deep impact on me for a lot of different reasons. I mean, what Ted Kaczynski did was articulate the dangers of technology, and he himself was a mathematician. So he does so in a logical fashion, beginning with certain premises and moving from there. He explores various possibilities. Pretty much all of them are negative. But among the most frightening is that the machinery of industrial society, kind of its own momentum, not as if it had come alive, although that's one of the possibilities, but the momentum of the system itself would be such that human beings would be imprisoned in a mechanical trap of our own making, or of the making of the elites above us.
Wow.
And so that's what freaked him out. That's why he went on his bombing campaign. What's also ironic about it, though, is that it is very, very logical, his argument. So logical, you would think that he himself was a computer, right?
Wow.
And I think that was probably a big reason that he flipped out and couldn't see the beauty of life outside of this logical construct that he had come up with. And just one other point on that, I really do believe that despite all of the logic of his arguments, and I think that a lot of his arguments have actually borne out, it's still primarily, it was an aesthetic thing for him. That's my going theory. If I'm going to psychoanalyze Ted, it began with an emotional dissonance and then moved from there. So but after that, you know, I would say another big point, and there were many others between, but 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11, and the declaration of a worldwide surveillance grid, the open institution of all sorts of electronic-based security checkpoints, yeah, and all mm-hmm. of that. I myself didn't, I wasn't exactly happy about a terrorist attack or anything like that. I was very quickly disillusioned with the war, but my real concern was that the security state just openly declared that they were going to begin, yeah, monitoring people's lives, mm-hmm, go on, so on and so forth. You know, when I was at Boston University, I was associated with the Center for Mind and Culture. It's a think tank run in association with Boston University, founded by my advisor, Wesley Wildman. Wonderful man, wonderful people there. One of the best people that I met there at Boston University and the center was a man, Justin Lane. He's an Oxford-trained AI expert, and so he brought in a lot of heavy hitters.
So what year was this?
This is 2015.
Okay.
Through really, ultimately, 2015 through 18, 19, really. I kept hanging around.
Okay.
Even after getting my degree. But Lane was really the one. I mean, of course, I knew what artificial intelligence was, or thought I did, and, it was, part of the kind of the framework of the worldview that I had, but it was really after meeting him that I came to understand the nuts and bolts at least better. I'm not a coder, but he very over years he's explained to me how the algorithms work, and my attempt to convey that in plain terms really is I owe it all to him, but he shouldn't be blamed for anything I get wrong.
Okay, so can you break down for us what is exactly AI,
and when did that term begin? How long has that been there? And I guess it tied all this into one package. But the difference between just technology that does things, mm-hmm, in the computer and AI, Like, where does technology end and AI mm-hmm. begin, and where does that take place?
The dream of AI goes back. I don't think you could put a pinpoint on it. You know, some of the earliest myths about artificial humanoid beings go back 2,500 years, you know, to the ancient Greeks, ancient Buddhists.
Really?
Ancient Chinese, yes. You know, humanoids that were brought to life, or even mechanical humanoids in the case of the... There's one really amusing Chinese myth where the emperor or the king, the ruler, commissions the creation of a kind of mechanical humanoid male, and he begins flirting with the concubines, and so the emperor has him taken back apart and decommissioned.
Really?
Yeah. And then, you know, there's legends in Buddhism that the Buddha's remains were guarded by what we would call robots, right? Like, you know, statues that are brought to life. You know, you have stories of Hephaestus in ancient Greece doing the same, and, you know, his kind of women of gold, golden women. And also, I believe it comes out of Homer, I believe, the legend of Talos, again, kind of mechanical humanoid that guards the island of Crete. So the idea goes back a long way, and they pop up again and again and again. The Golem, which is an ancient Jewish myth, but really came into its own in the 16th century in Prague, in what's now Czech Republic. But artificial intelligence, the term, came out of the famous Dartmouth Conference in 1956, John McCarthy and a number of others. I believe Marvin Minsky was there. If not, I believe he was there. Anyway, artificial intelligence was coined by John McCarthy then, and the idea of artificial intelligence then was simply to make a machine that could think. Mm-hmm. And throughout World War II, you had the beginnings of what we now call computer technology, and the dream then of they just simply using what they had then logically inferred you could keep making that machine more and more sophisticated, so the information processing would be closer and closer to what humans do. And, you know, side by side with that, you got to remember the mechanistic understanding of the brain, like to the worldview that sees the human brain as a sort of machine, a very, very complex machine, mm-hmm. That had already been introduced and had a lot of momentum among intellectuals. So now the idea that you can make a machine that was like a brain, you know, if there's no soul, there's no God, there's not really a good reason you couldn't, and there's not a good reason you shouldn't. So
what year was that probably?
1956 was when the term itself was coined, and the definition of artificial intelligence in brief, making a machine that could think like a human. It was around that time Alan Turing, who also was on this cultural path, had come up with the Turing test. And it's just simply, how would you, once you've come up with this machine, how would you be able to identify it as an intelligent being as opposed to just mere mechanism? And he suggested the Turing test, which is to have the respondents invisible to the questioner, and have a machine and have a human, and ask them, the human would ask them both questions, and humans, and if 70% of those questioning believed that the machine was in fact a human, then it would be then considered intelligent. And according to pretty much, people still argue, if there's one thing that artificial intelligence experts are always doing is flexing ego. So if one says something, even if the other agrees, they're always, but a lot of people agree, and certainly Sam Altman, Elon Musk, people like that, they believe we're well past the Turing test with things like ChatGPT. You know, whatever. the real point, though, is that this dream is old.
Mm-hmm.
And unless it's done in secret, unless there is a secret lab, a secret server farm buried deep within the earth that contains an artificial general intelligence, and many conspiracy theorists insist that that's in fact the case, then nothing like that exists now. But people still call what we're using artificial intelligence. And what happened around the 80s and into the 2000s is you had the development of different systems that could perform narrow functions.
Okay.
So some of the earliest ones were handwriting recognition, mm-hmm. and text recognition, optical character recognition, mm-hmm. And even facial recognition, object recognition had begun. So and other things. And those narrow capabilities going into the 2000s really began to ramp up. And then there was really a big burst in the last 10 years of innovation. And so the way to describe that as being a form of intelligence without calling it AI, like real AI, mm-hmm. what was oftentimes called real AI, it was divided in two different ways. I'll only focus on one. Artificial narrow intelligence versus artificial general intelligence was one solution. That was Shane Legge, who was at Google at the time, went on to co-found DeepMind, which but Shane Legge coined artificial general intelligence, if I recall correctly, 2005. And then the term itself was made popular by a man, Ben Goertzel. A lot of people recognize him from his leopard skin cowboy hat. And he held a lot of conferences around the world in very prestigious areas. They're tech-saturated. And this concept of artificial general intelligence. So narrow intelligence would be facial recognition, protein modeling, weapons control systems.
What's protein modeling mean?
To model how a protein would fold after, or, you know, given a certain genome.
Okay.
So DeepMind has a program called AlphaFold, but there are a lot of other similar programs. Protein folding has been notoriously difficult for biologists. DeepMind has had tremendous breakthroughs in being able to predict how a protein would fold from first principles. It's not been tested extensively in the lab, so we'll see how accurate it is, but it's technically speaking, it is really amazing. But yeah, artificial narrow intelligence is just those narrow capacities.
Mm-hmm.
General intelligence is gluing them all together into one being. It's also interesting, again, if you look at the human brain, right, even just what we're doing right now, and you look into my eyes and you know use your internal dissecting mad scientist, you can imagine just the eyeball as a machine and then the optic nerve going into the visual cortex, and that would be a one narrow intelligence, right? Because it is, in fact, creating an image from nothing but the mechanisms. And then from there, say, the facial recognition, you would have the memory inside my hippocampus and distributed across the brain. You could imagine that. And if it's just that, if it was just, you know, you imagine just my eyeball with an optic nerve and the visual cortex and the hippocampus just sitting here floating in front of you with no other external casing and other modules, you might say that that is something like an intelligence. It's a cognitive module. So I think it's justifiable to call artificial narrow intelligence an AI. But a lot of stuff gets the AI stamp, you know, when in fact it's just simply a computer program that's a bit more sophisticated than your run-of-the-mill. A good way to think about it, I'll give you a real quick schema. When you look at computer programming, you have first algorithms, just step-by-step processes to get from the input or the output, the input to some sort of productive output. Next, you would have machine learning. And in machine learning, it's an algorithm, but it's a much more complex algorithm. Instead of the rules-based programming where it's like an Excel spreadsheet, you put the input in, you have definite rules, and then the output is very predictable from those rules. With machine learning, it's an algorithmic process where the machine itself is raking over the data and extracting meaningful patterns on its own.
Is that considered AI or no?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but yes, I would say you're now moving into the realm of AI.
Asking Joe Allen.
I think it's safe to call it AI. It's simpler that way than, you know, splitting hairs. But there are many people who would say no, none of it's AI. Because they're talking about the original, the real AI definition, right?
Okay. That would have come from 1956.
1956 and even before, yeah.
Okay.
So, and then from machine learning, you get the kind of next level, which is deep learning. And again, machine learning is algorithms, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just more complex algorithms that are somewhat self-determined and a bit non-deterministic. They kind of have freedom, wiggle room. With deep learning systems, AlphaFold would be a really good example. ChatGPT would be another really good example at the time. It was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, deep learning systems. Deep learning is just an extension of machine learning. In general, it means an artificial neural network. And what that means is that you have basically a simulation of sorts of the processes of the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that instead of neurons, you have nodes. Instead of axons and dendrites, you have parameters. But if you've ever seen the schema of an artificial neural network, you know, you'll have like the input layer. You have all these different connections. You have these hidden layers in between and the output. And of course, even those schemas are kind of deceiving because what it actually would look like is, you know, millions or even billions. But it just gives you an idea of how the information flows through it. And so because of that subtlety and that complexity, deep learning is going over. It's basically just machine learning writ large. It is able to process, a deep learning system is able to process far more data and with much more subtlety. And the output is going to be that much more unpredictable.
And that's ChatGPT.
ChatGPT is a great example.
Okay.
And you know what? ChatGPT is a good example of the argument over whether something is or isn't artificial intelligence, because it is in some sense. Like if you had a dog that could write a crummy poem, you would say it's intelligent.
Yeah.
Even if the poem was crummy.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Even if it wasn't even an original poem, right? Like the dog had just been sitting and reading, you know, all the poets.
People would come from miles around. We could actually charge for them to come.
They'd probably worship it.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
You know, be like, what is this?
Yeah. So I think that this whole, I understand the derision and skepticism around ChatGPT, like, oh, it's not really intelligent. It's just a plagiarist machine or so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. But so are mediocre writers. So it represents a real step forward with the technology.
There's a kind of famous YouTube clip out of Jordan Peterson, and it's gone around a lot, where he's on a panel and he's discussing, and he's talking about, I think it was himself, maybe someone else, that were entering information into ChatGPT, and it was basically asked it to use his 10 rules book.
Yes.
But make up another one. And I think in like the King James version, but using like a Chinese philosopher's beliefs, and it did it almost immediately. And he read what it came up with and was astounded at how brilliant it was. It was like as if he wrote it in a King James version through the philosophical lens of this Chinese philosopher as well. And he was like, this is something that baffled him. He was awestruck.
Yes.
At what happened. Is the fact that someone as brilliant as Jordan Peterson being awestruck, does that immediately define it as being artificial intelligence, or is it just a match to somebody who had to rub sticks together? Is it just an evolutionary jump, or does that mean it actually has the thinking ability, or is it just so much more computing power that it could just connect a lot more things than we can wrap our minds around?
Well, you're tempting me to mock Jordan Peterson and therefore tempting your audience to hate me for those who are JPB fans or JBP fans. You know, that was in Canada not that long ago. I think it was at the beginning or the end of last year.
Yeah, I think so.
And Peterson was certainly cheerleading GPT. He said, it's smarter than you, and in 2 years, it'll be a hell of a lot smarter than you.
Yep.
So look out. I mean, I can see why he would be completely freaked out.
Oh, look at it. You got an image of him here now. You can tell he's ticked off. He's going to rain hellfire on you, Joe.
This is a family show, so I won't say, I won't repeat my alternate title for 12 Rules for Life, but I'll give him this. That opening chapter on the lobsters, the biological hierarchy in lobsters and its relationship to us, maybe not an original observation, but very well written.
Mm.
And I think that he's a pretty amazing thinker, in regard to mythology. So good things to say about Jordan Peterson. A great man, a great, great mind.
But that astounding gap, though, I mean, can I answer the question, though? Forget the personalities involved, but answer the question of does something that's so far beyond your capability that would have taken him the rest of his lifetime to create being done in 2 minutes, does that signify artificial intelligence, or does that just means increased computing capability?
I think it's a little bit of both, mostly in the case of GPT, the latter, but you know, the example he used, if I recall correctly, is to compare the ethics in the Sermon on the Mount with the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, which is something, I mean, you know, for me, that was really a turning point in my life in my 20s, very early 20s, doing exactly that. And I think that has been for many people going along the way. And for him to have said that, I'd have to see the essay. I don't know. I would imagine that it was probably pretty stiff. But I'm sure he was very impressed. I think it actually brings up a couple of things. One, the technical capabilities. So definitely 5 years ago would have been impossible. Mm-hmm. No computer, certainly 10 years ago would have been impossible. You would not be able to ask a computer to compare the Sermon on the Mount with the Tao Te Ching and it come back with anything sensible. It's a really amazing mm-hmm. increase in the technical capabilities. But then you have this other layer, the layer of the human response to it, in this case, Jordan Peterson. And it freaks him out, mm-hmm. right? He recognizes something insightful in mm-hmm. the analysis. And I don't deny that. You do get that out of these systems, at least when they're operating at their peak. And so the question that it really raises is what are we going to be good for if these machines get better and better?
That's actually what I was getting ready to ask. So my question is, it's obvious that you're going to get rid of jobs.
Yes.
You know, obviously, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure that out. But so that's a problem. But what are some things that maybe we haven't thought about that is really a problem, an underlining thing with what we just saw there with Jordan Peterson?
I think for me, what really disgusted me about that whole talk that he gave was that he just had the sense of kind of giving up. You know, there was no fight in him, and there wasn't, at least for my taste, enough skepticism of the value of the entire process. He did highlight the horror of having a machine that compares to or even excels beyond human capabilities. But, you know, Jordan Peterson swings on Musk's jock in a way that just makes me want to slap the man. And that's exactly what he immediately went to. Like, oh, Elon Musk, he's actually wanting to make a Neuralink that, you know, and AIs that would be, you know, smaller AIs that would be able to, you know, you would turn to protect you in this new world. Anyway, God, I can't stand it. It's especially not so. now
that's
this
scary,
new
yeah.
this new post-Xanax Daily Wire Jordan Peterson. It
creates that vibe of like you're a horse looking at the invention of a tractor.
Yes.
You know, it creates that kind of
it does, for sure, of
this gap in capability.
Anything creative. I mean, any kind of like book writing or songwriting or any kind of art.
A painter.
They're done.
Yes. I think with visual arts especially, look, you know, this is oftentimes brought up. I was speaking to a gentleman just the other day in Nashville, actually. Very brilliant man, a programmer himself, and he was falling on the same. It's a very common argument, but this is basically these are just plagiarism. It's just plagiarism software. Okay, but all artists have influence. All writers have influence. Mm-hmm. And if you were really nitpicking, you could find an AI could find an artist's influence quite easily.
But there's a big difference between Ice Ice Baby and Under Pressure.
Yes, you know, there is. I mean, you know,
regardless of
Moonlight Sonata, right? Like, I think the subtlety and the complexity is something. It's a kind of a metric that you can turn to, but the real question is: so, will a program like DALL-E or a program like Midjourney be able to put out a business 60%, 70%, 99% of all graphic artists? Because most graphic artists, as original as they are not that original, and they're not that genius. They're just kind of they're putting something together for a commercial product. Mm-hmm. That I think we're already beyond that threshold. I think it's possible that graphic artists will find innovative ways to use it so that they remain relevant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But certainly all the effort that went into it, that's mm-hmm. all gone.
So to get to this point, there's like three categories here. There's one of human acceptance, you know, that changed, say, maybe since 9/11. You mentioned that shifted a lot of things. I know in our generation, there was a meme on Facebook recently that showed a cartoon, but it showed like 20 years ago. It was like, hey, careful what you're saying on the phone. It could be wiretapped.
Yeah.
And then today you're like, hey, wiretap, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow?
Yes.
And so there's an acceptance of this interaction with technology and a dismissiveness of our individual rights. The other category would be the amount of memory available in the world, mm-hmm. you know, where, you know, iPhones now have a terabyte, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, that kind of stuff, where that probably didn't even exist on the whole planet all put together not very long ago. So the amount of memory and data, and then the number of interfaces into our world mm-hmm. to allow the interactions for the devices to learn, you know, more. So we're more accepting.
All stemmed in convenience.
Yeah. Yes. So those three things seem to be all working in concert together to really accelerate what we're experiencing.
Yeah, and the argument you hear over and over and over again about the rationale for early adoption and kind of unbridled adoption and deployment is based on competition, economic competition in particular, but also military competition, even personal status competition, something that I try to point out, and I've been pointing out quite a bit in these lectures, that think about the automobile and the status that it carries. So if I drive up in a clunker versus I drive up in a hot rod, it is people, unless you are really in tune with the person, people are going to immediately judge that person based on the technology that they're deploying or that they have at their disposal.
Okay.
Same thing if I pull out a clunky old flip phone. Or I don't have a phone, and you have an iPhone 14. It's kind of like, look at this guy.
Yep.
And so on and so forth. And I think that that's also, so you've got status, you've got military competition, but really the big thing is economic competition. How are you going to keep up, to stick with graphic arts, how are you going to keep up if your graphic arts company, if your graphic design company is producing an image, you know, one artist can produce an image over the course of like 4 or 5 hours, and he's going to burn out before too long in the day.
And we'll be right back with Joe Allen.
You know, Christmas is right around the corner, and I cannot think of a better person to support than Mike Lindell with MyPillow. You know, when you go to MyPillow.com and use promo code FLYOVER, you get up to 66% off on your purchases. It helps Mike Lindell, it helps the Flyover Conservatives, and it helps you as well. You know, my very favorite product from MyPillow.com are their slippers. They are so comfortable. They are like truly a hug for your feet.
I'm a big fan of the dog beds because, number one, I love my dog. He lays his life on the line for us every single
day.
He does. Every person that walks by the house, every package that's dropped off, you know, he's always there for you. So you want him to sleep good at night. But, you know, we've gone through a lot of dog beds. I have a big dog.
He's a Doberman.
He's a Doberman. So the kind that with the big, you know, squishy pad, you know, that gets slept on, it gets dirty, there's nothing you can do with it. With a MyPillow bed, it's got the patented fill as a pillow. You can take the inside out and wash it, and then you can dry it, and it's fresh and ready to go. And then you can take the cover, wash it, dry it, and it's ready to go.
You can even buy new covers, too.
Yeah, replace the covers. It lasts a long time. The dogs love it. It feels good. The other great thing about supporting Mike Lindell is you're also supporting those who work for him. Mm-hmm. His products are all made here in the United States with his factory in Minnesota. And the kind of heat that company has come against for standing up for truth not only impacts Mike because he's in this as deep as anybody, but the people that stand behind Mike. So you can get a 66% discount or even greater on some products. Support a great company, support a great person, and as well as the people that work for Mike.
That's exactly right. So go to MyPillow.com. Use promo code FLYOVER.
What you doing there, Mom?
Well, Wesley and I got all in the Christmas spirit after decorating, and we decided to make a naughty and nice list. And I have to say, Avery, you're doing quite well.
Really?
So we're trying to decide who all we're going to buy MyPillow stuff for Christmas. You know, if you use promo code FLYOVER, you get up to 66% off when you go to MyPillow.com.
That's a great deal.
Can't beat it.
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
Promo code FLYOVER.
Whereas you've got DALL-E or Midjourney, now all you need is a prompt engineer. Prompt engineer doesn't need to have much talent, maybe a bit of vision, an aesthetic sense. Just ask it to make it and do it in the style of this, do it in the style of that. Eventually, you know, you end up with the Ouroboros dilemma, you know, where the snake eats its own tail. Mm-hmm. Eventually you run out of people whose style you can steal. But until then, you will have wiped out all these jobs. And maybe more importantly, you will have basically, really, it's kind of paralyzing, demoralizing for people who want to be artists or people who want to be writers or people who want to be anything. This idea a machine is going to do it better than you, whether it's true or not, that's being pushed into the populace. So young people today are facing a world in which they at least have the idea that their obsolescence is imminent. And that may or may not be true. I mean, these machines are getting better and better. That much I have no doubt of. But there's, you know, it's not as simple as just the machine. Like I say, there's the human response. There's the sales pitch. And from the government, there's, you know, occasionally mandates like this crazy, this wacky new mRNA technology, for instance. It was a little bit of a sales pitch. It was a little bit of government mandate. So
I love how Colton puts up your vocabulary words. That was great. He's like, in case you didn't know what that word means, here you go.
But I really, to me,
thanks, Colton.
Whether these, let's just say that the idea of an artificial general intelligence is a valid one. Let's say that the timeline that Elon Musk is going with, or Shane Legg, or Greg Brockman, they all are talking about, and Ben Goertzel, the leopard skin hat guy, they're all talking about 2030. Mm-hmm. Ray Kurzweil, the
singularity,
the man who really put the singularity on the map, really articulated that notion that the technology is going to rocket past human capability. He predicted 2030 as the moment AGI would.
And what year
emerge.
Was that that he predicted it?
It was part of the singularity is near.
Okay.
And so at least as far back as the early 2000s, that book was published in 2005. That's a good question, though, when he first predicted it. But then the singularity would be something that would come out of that. Mm-hmm. Once you had human level intelligence, and in fact, he's already a little bit off, because really what he was predicting is whole brain emulation. Meaning that you would be able to emulate a human brain in a computer. Now, we're not actually very close to that at all. So in a sense, they're boosting his prediction in a way that's disingenuous. But what is happening, these neural networks, these artificial neural networks, which operate very, very differently than a human brain, are at least approaching some capabilities sort of like a human brain. Anyway, the mythos is, I think, really, really important. The mythos is that by 2030, you're going to have artificial general intelligence. And once you have that, all bets are off, because you know, if it's like a human brain, it's going to have its own will. It's going to have its own interests. And it's, you know, many say it's going to deserve its own legal rights. Maybe it'll be one, or, you know, if they keep it contained in that secret lab and, you know, held over a vat of acid in case you need to pull the plug.
Yeah.
But because of the nature of software, you could replicate, you know, given however much space you might have, you could replicate it one time, two times, 10 times, a million times, a billion times. That's what they envision. That it could just endlessly replicate, right? Until maybe there's more artificial general intelligences by 2040 than there are human brains.
When they take over.
Because of all that, then, Kurzweil believes we'll hit the singularity by 2045. All these tech titans, and they were relatively silent on this forever, or at least very, very rarely mentioned it, Elon Musk, Shane Legg, Sam Altman, Greg Brockman, all these people are now kind of speaking in terms and deferring to Kurzweil's authority on this. So seemingly they believe that the singularity will occur, and it's just the confluence of all these different technologies advancing and the possibilities that are opened up by an artificial intelligence that can, you know, model robotics very, very quickly, even start designing robotics. Same thing with biology.
So
right?
Like creating themselves?
That would be also a part of it, right? Both creating both a machine that could design its own body, so to speak, or at least in partnership with humans, accelerate the designs. Also redesign its own software, because it would be able to, in theory, find all of these improvements it could make to its own software. And, Nick Bostrom, the Oxford philosopher, founder of the World Transhumanist Movement, calls this an intelligence explosion. That you would just get this rapid, hard takeoff, potentially. And it could happen within, conceivably 10 to 15 minutes or over the course of a year. But as it was self-improving, it would by its very nature be out of human control. You can't have something that intelligent, according to this dream, that a human could control. You could trap it, but even then, if it's that much smarter than you, it'll find a way out, according to the theory. So that's the worldview that's coming out of Silicon Valley.
Is that why Elon Musk is saying we need to probably slow this down?
Yes.
Obviously, we're speculating, but.
And is he really saying slow this down? Sometimes when you hear that, it's like three people at a race, you're going to race, and right before the gun goes off, oh, hey, what's that? And then you go, kind of thing. Is it to slow everyone else down so that you have an edge? Or do they really think out of the goodness of humanity, we need to keep the toothpaste in the tube a little longer?
You'd have to ask his closest confidants, and something tells me
that's why you're here.
I would love to get some answers directly from Musk, but so far the interview has not been arranged. Him and Steve don't get along at all. But yeah, what they're saying, and I see no reason to assume that they're being disingenuous, although I assume that they're salesmen.
Yeah.
And I've yet to meet a salesman that I've known well that was simply selling what, you know, he thought. So, but Musk is talking about slowing it down. Altman was talking about slowing it down for a bit. A lot of people talk about it, but Musk is also working on his own artificial intelligence system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Musk's mythos, which Jordan Peterson is disseminating through his sort of quasi-religious lectures, but Musk's mythos is that if you're going to have a world in which people are creating these things, you're going to need good ones because one might go bad. And so Musk will be one of the creators of the good ones. Maybe it will be an artificial general intelligence that he creates that's like kind of a savior god to combat the satanic evil AGI that, who knows, maybe China will create it, which is unlikely. They're pretty far behind. Or maybe it'll be the one Sam Altman's creating against Musk's will.
Yeah, you know, and it, all that's under the assumption that I created my dog, you know, or something that I can control. But,
yeah.
But if I'm creating myself, you know, that never gets tired and doesn't need a vacation or, you know, any of these things.
Then get sick.
Yeah, that's your, it does have that create a monster kind of a vibe. And the thing I love about you is you have a background, you know, an understanding theology and understanding the mix of this, because we're not sitting here talking with three meat suits at the table.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's, if you cut off my arms and my legs, I'm still me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, if I gain 100 pounds, lose 100 pounds, it's like, I'm still, that's, I'm not these fingernails.
Right.
You know, there's another.
You have a spirit, you have a soul.
Yeah. And you know what? Also, neither is my dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has thoughts and fears, and, you know, he likes some people, doesn't like some people. There's an interesting thing going on there, but I also don't have this idea, and don't cry when I say this, but I don't think, you know, that he has the ability to, like, experience salvation, go to heaven, have a, you know, there's a, not this, you know, a soul to him. We could argue that. You're like, I don't know.
I would argue this.
I argue it. But no need to go there.
You know, but there's a complexity that makes us, that makes humans uniquely different than animals. And, you know, so there's
we're created in God's image.
Yeah. So so there's a lot more that all dogs go to heaven. They made a movie about it.
There you go.
But so bring it up. What makes us uniquely human based on, you know, all of your study and philosophy and personal experience? And what separates us from man-made technology that can maybe learn at our level or greater?
A lot of it is what I would maybe call human racism. That we're
a speciesist.
Speciesist, right?
I'm probably a speciesist.
Yeah, and it's again, it's more of an aesthetic question than it is. You know, all the morality and rationalization comes out of just the sense, this is us, and that's them.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to create them, right, there's kind of two choices. And you hear this a lot from tech guys. You either create something that's free, that could conquer you, or you enslave it. And so someone like Musk is of the philosophy you enslave it. Or at least that's something of what he's pitching, right? He says, I am a speciesist and all this. And yet he still speaks in terms of creating, I mean, for instance, this you know, XAI project, the goal is to create an AGI that is curious about the world, that wants to understand the universe, which is pretty much all of them. You know, this is branding.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, it has to be free. And if it's free and it has any kind of power principle whatsoever, then it's possible that it's going to want to dominate other humans. A lot of this distracts us, though, from what's actually happening, which is that these tech companies are creating technologies that work for them, that are oftentimes useful in our lives. But the real question is, who's getting the most out of this deal? And my own assessment, again, is as aesthetic as it is a calculation and an analysis. But my own assessment is that from the explosion of even the internet, by and large, the increasingly the proportion of benefit is much more going towards these corporations or the governments that are oftentimes in association with these corporations producing them. They're getting all the goods. Mm-hmm. They're getting all your data. They're manipulating you. Mm-hmm. They are oftentimes changing, they're disrupting society in ways that are profoundly unhealthy for the people that are involved. Mm. And it's a total rupture. You don't need like a singularity that's a rupture with all history because you've created God in silico. Mm-hmm. If you've just turned everyone into these sort of, you know, half-baked cyborgs, which is what we've largely become, mm-hmm. Especially the more immersed and saturated we are with these technologies. So, you know, to talk about AI as if it weren't, as if it were already its own entity, it really is it's a religious thing in the sense that from an atheist point of view, right, it would be a religious thing. You're talking about something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. You're just talking about dreams, right? But what's really interesting about it is that these dreams are coming true. To some extent, maybe they'll never hit. Maybe today is the last day we'll get any advances at all in these things, and it'll stay where it's at now. Even if so, the major theological questions that these technologies raise are still present. So the two big ones that I would say, the two big theological technological questions are: Can human beings create a being that is equal to or greater than a human being? Mm. Is that possible? Norbert Wiener, hilariously named, but the very brilliant scientist who coined the term cybernetics in the 60s, wrote a book called God and Gollum Inc. And he asked that very question. Mm. It's very similar to Aquinas asking, could God create a boulder heavier than he could lift?
Right.
So can man create a thing greater than himself? And it's a very profound question. And without answering that, just raising the second question, should human beings create such a thing, would it be conscious? Mm. Would there be a soul inside of it?
Yeah, that's my big question, mm-hmm. right there.
Myself, if you want to know I don't have a definite answer, obviously. I mean, nobody does. But I suspect this. If you believe that disincarnate entities exist, if you believe that in some sense the soul that is experiencing everything that we're experiencing now will move on beyond this body, then you believe in a non-corporeal entity that is imbued with experience, imbued with intelligence, perhaps imbued with emotion. I see no reason that you could not have such a thing in an animal. I see no reason you couldn't have such a thing in a machine. The division, many people put the boundaries around the human and say that only the human can have the soul. We could be up all night talking about that one. Mm-hmm. For myself, I do believe that such a thing is real, that I think that what we're experiencing right now, just, you know, in this conversation, mm-hmm. souls in meat, mm-hmm. but souls indeed. And another way of looking at it, if you believe that it's possible for sorcerers, spoken of in the Bible, you know, and increased in popularity over mm-hmm. the last century quite a bit, to the point that you can buy a Ouija board from a toy store. Mm-hmm. If you believe that sorcerers are not just, you know, painting pictures and calling to the void, to nothingness, and you believe that there are entities on the other end of that, and so that if a sorcerer draws the pentagram and summons the demon, mm-hmm. that they in fact are summoning demons, then I see no reason to believe that the sorcerers in Silicon Valley, who oftentimes speak of this in this fashion, who oftentimes are practitioners of magic, oftentimes many of them in the tradition of Aleister Crowley, there's no reason to believe that they aren't in fact summoning a demon in these machines, that the machine is in fact imbued with spiritual forces.
So it's giving basically a demon, because a demon wants a human, wants a body to live in. So you're saying it's basically giving the demon a place to live.
That's how I envision it.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that that's the reality, because I question my own perception of all this as much as anything, you know, mm-hmm. but that's my impression. Absolutely.
Which that is obviously been the goal since the very beginning, since the angels fell, demons were there. That's their whole thing, is how do we get into the human body? You know, or even they took over swine. So Jesus cast demons out of the man into the pigs. then the pigs ran into the water and drowned. So that's an interesting, Okay, so as you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, what are, when you are looking at it, what are the, where does it get dangerous? Where is AI actually useful for the normal human being, not these elites, but normal human beings? Where is that actually useful and safe? And is there something like that? And where does it cross the line to now that has become very dangerous and this could really hurt us?
I see all of it as being pretty negative. I mean, I'm not saying that...
no, that's good, because you don't like smartphones, is that right?
I would get rid of it tomorrow if I could. And, I mean, technically I could, but I wouldn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would get rid of that if I could. I wouldn't be a total primitivist. In fact, I'd probably get on the internet now and again.
Mm-hmm.
But I would probably live a very, very different life, and was living a very, very mm-hmm. different life.
Kind of like Amish?
Maybe not go that far, but something like that.
Yeah.
And also,
sometimes it can be very appealing.
Everybody's got to draw a line somewhere. They chose like 1860 or whatever, right. You know, kind of as nothing else, no more.
Yeah.
You know,
some good things have come out of that.
And I tell you what, if I was out there on the farm and I got my arm cut off, you can be sure that I'm not going to be waiting around for the witch doctor to come put it back on for me. I will go to the most modern hospital I could.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully one of the Amish had the wherewithal to store some snow so we could put it on ice.
Yeah.
These are really, really tricky questions though, right? Like, so, you know, people oftentimes ask me like, what do we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And my first question is, who's we?
Wow. Good question.
Great question.
Because we're going to have, the three of us are going to have very different ideas of what to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
And not to make a lot of assumptions, but, you know, at least on minor points, probably the two of you have different mm-hmm. ideas, at least on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm certain that David's authority is the final word.
And it is.
Yep.
He's the head of our house.
Yeah, well... choose wisely, sir.
we are in a time where those kind of decisions are bigger.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, talk with my son, and they got 3-year-old, and do you allow them to mess with phones and have screen time or not?
Right.
If so, how much?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, well, that seems harmless, and you know, it's like these are all new things that previous generations never dealt with.
We never had that. You know?
Well, one thing that
this technology woven into our world, you know, mm-hmm. and it just doesn't end.
One thing that does bring up, and I think it's a really important one. I myself am not a parent. I'm enjoying the fruits of an ill-spent youth, well into my later years, unfortunately. But those of my friends who do have children, and what I consider to be some of the wisest experiments in this very mm-hmm. experimental time. Is one in which you teach the children competency in these technologies, but don't allow them the sort of degenerate or very decadent indulgence in these technologies. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably a wise path forward. I mean, I'm not going to be writing parroting self-help books, right? So it is really kind of up to them.
You know a lot more than most people do about technology. A lot of times, you know, it's just out of ignorance that somebody would... you know, do that, not because they're malicious, that I'm trying to hurt my child. It's they just have no idea. Because I even heard you made a comment about homeschooling.
Yeah.
The danger of homeschooling with AI and technology.
Yes.
Can you touch on that as well?
I see that as being a real danger going forward. And, just to frame it, this techno-fetishism or this tech accelerationist movement is definitely not some left-wing thing. In fact, it's primarily libertarian, and I would say that a disturbing proportion of conservatives that I know, not libertarians, but conservatives, religious mm-hmm. conservatives, are actually quite excited about incorporating these technologies into their lives. So when you talk about using AI, like one-on-one AI tutors or just e-learning in general, mm-hmm. for me, aesthetically, that transmission of information from human to human, you know, from my uncle and grandfather, my mother to me, then my teachers and various mentors in business and academia going forward, all of that human-to-human transmission, mm-hmm. So important, so, so important.
Yep.
The information is one part of it, but the entire personality or community around it mm-hmm. is another really rich part of it. So homeschooling, while I think that any parent who is homeschooling is probably – doing kind of what has to be done at a time like this. We're in a very, we're in a dark eon, as it were. But if they turn to this AI, one-on-one AI tutoring, it could just be something minor, something supplemental. to a real human educator. Mm-hmm. But in general, that's not going to be what happens. Like super educated, super intelligent parents are going to give their kids a very, very good education. And if they're doing it in partnership with each other and sharing their expertise and pooling their expertise, then that kid is going to get, or those kids are going to get, a fantastic education. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about people who just don't have, they weren't privileged to have the educational background to really teach their kids well how to survive in the new world, or any world mm-hmm. for that matter. And you know, to be quite frank, parents who don't have the cognitive capacity to do it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the natural alternative is going to be to find some way of bringing a trusted expert into the process. So when I was kicked out of school, my mom got me enrolled in this distance Bible school, which was ridiculous and it was pitiful, but she did, uh-huh. right? Just so that I wouldn't get taken away as a truant. So parents are going to have to be, they already are, right? They're doing this sort of thing where you've got like this distance learner who's grading your papers and all that. Whether you can trust that person or not with your kid's mind, it's a huge, yeah. huge jump, just yeah, like public school. But with AI, with one-on-one AI education, Bill Gates is really pushing this.
That's scary.
And then you've got Sal Khan, founder of Khan Academy.
Yeah.
Who the most popular e-learning platform, declaring in his recent TED Talk that he wants to get an AI one-on-one tutor to every child on the planet.
Wow.
Now, again, it's like if for those who have like really, really intelligent adults around them, the proportion of education coming through the AI is probably going to be smaller. It's going to be more supplemental. But for those who aren't, and that's going to be, you know, look at the old bell curve, it's going to be the majority of sure. them, the AI is going to be the primary mm. instructor. And maybe even for those who are intelligent, mm-hmm. you know, you never really know. It depends on how good the AI is.
Right.
And so what you're talking about, let's say that the AI is good at educating the child better than a human. What you're talking about is severing what was, you know, depending on where you want to put the date on it, but I would say severing what was roughly 250,000 years of humans passing down knowledge
yeah.
one to one mm-hmm. to one. And you were, at least on some bloodlines, severing it completely. And you're now remixing all of that with digital technology. I think that I have found many ways to rationalize mm-hmm. reasons that should not happen, and that you shouldn't do it, and I shouldn't do it, nobody mm-hmm. should do it. But in essence, for me, it's a speciesist thing. I think that we should simply continue to cultivate those lineages, those kind of apostolic succession, simply because we are human, and mm-hmm. that this is yeah. an alien force.
And part of, you know, learning, you know, you're learning by somebody pouring into you. But if you have to stop and explain something that you know how to do, it's like you're learning. Mm-hmm. It's just part of your development as a parent. There's a different level of development as a grandparent.
That's why little kids, why?
You're like,
what does that mean? Why? Because
why? You know?
Because why?
Right. And yeah. so then you got to actually explain, how does something work?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you've never probably thought about it, you know, and breaking that down. So everybody in that chain is learning,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it's very easy. As soon as a machine is doing something, you disengage. You know, you don't worry about vacuuming much if you have a Roomba.
Right.
You know, it's like you just kind of mm-hmm. let that go, you know. So every piece of ground we give up to technology, we lose kind of forever. One of them is the ability to wonder. You know, you used mm-hmm. to sit, there's five people at dinner, and you say, hey, who was in this movie? And you're like, oh, it was this guy. And you're like, no, it wasn't. He wasn't even born. Oh, yeah. Well, then, you know, it creates a discussion, yeah. and you still leave kind of wondering, you know, who, and you're going to go home and look at the DVD or something. But now nobody wonders because you just look it up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is bam. You know, so like we kind of gave every piece of ground technology takes, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
You don't go back.
You offload the cognition.
Yep, yeah.
Even as simple as phone numbers. I mean, when we were growing up, we knew everybody's phone number. Today, because it's in our phone, I don't know anybody's phone number. You know, right. I know a few, but you know, you click it, get into it.
We've married 30 years, 620-6487. I'm not going to say the whole number of people calling her folks. But that's Stacey's number when we were in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and I still know it. You know,
exactly.
We used to be a lot smarter.
Yeah. I mean, it's true.
Now I know like three.
It's crazy.
The only ones I remember, nobody's there anymore.
But it is wild, you know,
yes.
Even how to get to somebody's home or, you know, yes. to a place, you know, because you just depend on technology today where
So
we couldn't do that
along this trip. And now occasionally, you know, you have to pull out the old smartphone.
Sure.
You know, I've got it there. I'm not going to say I haven't gotten lost a couple times and turned to it in a time of need. But what I'll do is map it out before I go.
Yep.
And follow the directions I've written down. Use my old Rand McNally. I've been late. I was late here. you know, so it has its drawbacks, especially in a very fast paced environment. But yeah, that whole process of offloading cognition, one of the basic questions you ask yourself, you know, where am I at? Where am I going?
Mm-hmm.
So in just pure space, like in practical terms, Google's got you covered.
Mm-hmm.
It can tell you where you're at. It can tell you where you're going.
Yep.
It can even tell you what to want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And it does so regularly. On a more profound level, you know, who am I? Where am I at? And like, where am I going in my life?
Yeah.
More and more, those questions, you're not left to wonder very long and meditate deeply.
Mm-hmm.
There's an app for that. Mm-hmm. There are many apps for that.
Yeah.
And there are many social media networks in which this digitized information is the primary orientation that a person has to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a couple of videos we're gonna watch.
Yeah, sure.
You mentioned VR Church.
Yeah, that's a funny one.
Virtual reality church.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, DJ Soto, he formed this church. Oh, it's been so long since I actually looked at it. I believe in California. Let's leave the location out of it.
Okay.
Google probably knows. We can ask. But DJ Soto, whom I actually communicated with very briefly, he created this church in VR, 2015-16.
Okay.
Media picked it up. They boosted it out. This is before the metaverse became this meme. And his idea was that in VR church, people who are afraid of judgment wouldn't have to worry about being judged. Of course, the classic justification for these sorts of radical technologies, people who are paralyzed or homebound could enjoy church in VR.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it didn't take off in popularity. It's been around now for almost 7 years, and I don't know how much it's grown. Not very much.
Welcome to
Is this it? Okay.
It's our man.
Let's play it.
It's our man.
Welcome to Virtual Reality Church.
DJ Soto's divine calling is to bring Christianity to virtual reality.
So we have worship music. I deliver a sermon. There's a prayer team. There's all these elements just in a Ready Player One, Matrix Inception kind of virtual world. God is passionate about you. In the physical world, when you go to church, there's sometimes intrepidation, hesitation, because maybe people will judge me. But in VR, because of their avatar, there's a sense of anonymity. So with that anonymity leads to deep authenticity. So we're having these conversations that are just authentic and deep in VR.
DJ Soto even officiated the first baptism in virtual reality.
It absolutely felt real.
When she came out of the water, she was really emotional. She could hear her crying. That table where Jesus grabs it with one hand, he grabs it the other, and he's like, you best back up. You best back up because you got in the way of me and my children.
But he believes the future of Christianity is virtual.
I believe God is in multiple dimensions. He's in a spiritual dimension, the physical, and even in the digital and virtual. Yeah, I think God's everywhere. And I think God's in VR.
We'll be right back with Joe Allen.
You know, some of these topics about AI and how it affects banking and central bank digital currencies and their ability to watch and examine your transactions. You know, forget the deflating dollar. Just for a privacy standpoint, you don't want to be controlled by something you can't see or touch or see or feel. You know, just today, Jim Jordan has subpoenaed Bank of America for them releasing all bank records for anybody that used a credit card near D.C. on January 6th. Without a request, without anything, they released your personal bank information without even having to, if you were anywhere near mm-hmm. D.C. It's like, that's kind of a scary view of the future of what could possibly happen.
That's so true.
Having your money, your wealth, your assets in outside of the system, outside of that mm-hmm. matrix is important, but it's kind of mysterious. How do you do it? We have a connection with a guy named Dr. Kirk Elliott. We call him Dr. Doctor.
Two PhDs.
Not one, but two, and so yep. he deserves it. So we call
We've
him Dr.
known
Doctor.
Him for 25 years. We have an incredible relationship with him.
And he has an amazing team that can walk you through this process of how do you move your assets out of that system and have them in a physical form, either stored with you somewhere else. They can answer all those questions, clear up confusion, and kind of put you in a place where you can lay your head at night and sleep well, knowing that you're safe, you're secure, and you have an asset that instead of deflating every single day, it's actually increasing in value and purchasing power in the future. And then you can also
something that's tangible like silver.
And you can turn it back into cash or whatever you want within about 48 hours at any point in the future. So there's a lot of great moves. You have an IRA, savings, whatever you want to do, these guys can help you out. You go to flyovergold.com. It's just a landing page to get you into their world. And they just set up a conversation to educate you on what your options. So flyovergold.com can connect you with Dr. Kirk.
Or you can just call 720-605-3900 to set up your free consultation. This is a crazy time to be alive.
Well, just in our lifetime, used to be where you'd hear your grandparents talk about how cheap gas was and stuff. And it was 75 years before, 50 years you know, before.
And so we've seen a lot of changes since Biden took office. $700 more a month
than what you needed in January of 21 when he took office.
You might hear these kind of things and think, oh, that's overwhelming. I can't control the government. I can't control what they're doing. I can't control the spending. But we can take care of ourselves.
You want to make sure that you're buying bullion from somebody that you can trust and someone that does not charge you a commission when you go to sell.
If there's going to be a commission, have it on the front end, not the back end when it skyrockets. And now you're like, oh my gosh, look at this big, huge commission I got to pay because it's on the back end before I sell it.
You can buy an ounce of silver for $23. So this is something everybody can get into. And if silver goes to $50, if it goes to $75, if it goes to $100, all of those profits are yours. And that's happening while the dollar is buying less and less at the actual grocery store.
So you can go to flyovergold.com, fill out your information. When you do that, someone from Dr. Kirk's team will get a hold of you to set up a free consultation. It doesn't cost you any money whatsoever. Or to do the same thing, you can just call 720-605-3900.
Okay.
That is fascinating. Give us your take.
Pros and cons.
Talk about a hard severance with ancient tradition and a beginning of a new. People are going to do what they're going to do. You know, I would counsel anyone not to. And with that, really, you don't have to counsel too hard. It hasn't taken off.
Right.
But one of the strange things about technology is that they'll oftentimes stagnate or germinate for a long time and then explode. Not always. Sometimes it's just right there in your face. And sometimes they'll just hang around and just never really go anywhere. A good example would be the fantastic tech writer, even if he is a bit optimistic, Kevin Kelly, talked about a World's Fair, I believe it was in the 60s that he went to, in which they had a functional video phone.
Okay.
And it just sat there, right? Like they had it. It was ready. It was good to go. And that technology just sat there and didn't, nothing happened with it in the 60s.
1960s.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, but it just didn't, nobody used it, right? Like, nobody developed it, nobody invested in it. It just kept, people like the phone. There's no reason to go there. But it was, a certain degree of sophistication and marketing that saw the explosion of the smartphone and video.
Yeah.
And even then, if you remember the early smartphones, people weren't regularly talking to each other through it. Some of it's technological sophistication, but in that case, he points out, nobody had a tremendous interest in it until they did. And once they did, it became a norm. So with that, like VR church, people who, like the VR pioneers speak about VR in spiritual terms regularly. The Mark Pesce, the guy who really developed virtual reality markup language, the early coding language for VR. He was, I don't know how you classify him other than sort of a pagan magician. And he believed what he was working on was a kind of a magical spell that it was creating a realm like those that are talked about in religions the world over. Another, I cannot remember the Dutchman's name, but another pioneer that I wrote about some 3 years ago, he spoke of it as like an astral plane, like the Hindus would have spoken of, right?
Wow.
Another plane. Many people do, though. Yuval Harari speaks about virtual reality as the creation of heavens and hells, and people will come to embody them. And that will, in fact, be religion of the future, because people are going to be fairly useless due to their, obsolescence, automation has brought to them. And so they'll live in these heavens and hells, these virtual heavens and hells, until the bloodline zaps out. So there is something kind of fundamentally theological about virtual reality It's, you know, it synthesizes what mystics have spoken of since, you know, presumably the caveman days. I have visited another place. I could see it clearly. There were beings in this other place.
Yeah.
I come back and I tell you about them. Television does that. Mm-hmm. The computer does that. But virtual reality makes it real in a way that none of the others do. Mark Zuckerberg and many others talk about it in terms of presence, so that it's no longer something that's over here. When you encounter another entity in virtual reality, there's this presence. It's there. It's with you. Mm-hmm. And so, I see like what DJ Soto is doing. It's not unlike the next level. So one of the things he talks about doing is he would love for Bible stories to come alive in VR. And so you would be able to experience the, you know, Moses parting the Red Sea was an example he gave. But I hate to give people any bad ideas, but I foresee an era not too long from now in which people develop things like first person passion plays. And it raises questions like, where do you draw the line? Like, how far is too far?
Yeah. You bring up, you've all know Harari, and this has become a kind of a two-part question, but you know, he famously says, we've played it on our show tons of times, versions of him saying, you know, we have all these useless people and we'll just distract them with drugs and video games.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And he kind of used to do a little chuckle with it. He doesn't even do that anymore because he ended a talk recently with that.
Yep.
You know, and just walked off. Like, that was mm-hmm. his close and is done.
He literally closed his book and walked off.
And so it kind of brings up, you know, there's been a thing of the last few years of for the truck drivers, hey, let's go learn to code.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of like, hey, coder, go learn to hang sheetrock or, you know, wire a house or HVAC, you know, that these two things. But when you separate the need for me in the world, yet I still exist, you know, as these technologies remove my necessary function, you know, then I become maybe what? Like a lion in a cage and you just feed it steaks and it lives. It's fine. But yes. That's not really
that's what, not living.
That's not what lions were, mm-hmm. how they thrive. And so how does that play out?
I suspect that
in Harari's mind.
From Harari's point of view, I've spent a lot of time reading Harari. And one of these days, perhaps we'll bump into each other. Who knows?
You're on that path. Mm-hmm. You guys are in a small circle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people hate Harari because of his atheistic perspective and his sneering sort of persona. He's not a nice guy.
His overall vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his vibe. He's got a bad vibe. Yeah.
I don't think he has a lot of friends.
He's kind of Gollum-like.
Yes.
You know? Yeah, and, he is.
But I like weird people, and I sense a very brilliant mind in Harari's work. And I also, a lot of, you know, taken in small chunks, especially very carefully selected chunks, Harari comes off as much more malevolent than he really is, to the extent that I know anybody's heart. When he's talking about the you know, using drugs and computer games, he's not a tech guy, right? He's not a VR salesman at mm-hmm. Best Buy. He's a historian. And what he's talking about, he's making explicit something that is happening right now and has been happening for a long time. And I think that if nothing else, populists should probably thank him for bringing it to light, even if he was doing it on stage at the World Economic Forum.
Right.
Because you know who wasn't saying anything about that? Conservative leaders.
Mm.
They weren't saying a thing about it. By and large, they weren't mm-hmm. anyway, except for the most paranoid. The most paranoid and kind of psychotic minds have been saying it for longer than Harari, which is also an interesting mm-hmm. thing because they were also correct. They were psychotic, but correct.
Do you believe that Harari is doing it out of arrogance?
He's a very arrogant guy, for sure. Like his whole sneering sort of mm-hmm. thing, you know, he's
referred to as the prophet by Obama. And
yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But it's a dark prophecy. And it's one in which, you know, so real quick on the virtual reality and the drugs thing. That's happening. Mm-hmm. That's how many young men have poured all their virility into video games?
Yeah.
We're there.
We are there.
And
you're right.
If, you know, opioids, fentanyl. You know who you should point at? Not Harari. You should point at the Sackler family and at Purdue Pharma and the people who pushed out OxyContin through the doctors. Mm-hmm. Those mm-hmm. people should suffer very bad consequences. And you know who else should also suffer? Are the video game companies who created these alternate mm-hmm. worlds for young men to live out their lives. Whoever yeah. World of Warcraft guys and the Sacklers should be in the same place, mm-hmm. wherever that is. And all Harari's doing is pointing it out in a sneering fashion. You know, look at you, you're going away. Mm-hmm. But he is not doing it. He's simply pointing it out. The fact that he's sneering about it is galling.
He's not providing the products.
But right. these sure. people are doing yeah. it. And yeah. no one is really
stopping
it. And
getting very wealthy off of it.
And getting very wealthy. So, you know, what you're talking about really basically is this kind of algorithmic eugenics, whereupon certain technologies are being deployed to stop bloodlines from reproducing. Now, some people think that there's an overall eugenic plan, mastermind, you know, with a mastermind, maybe under the Alps in Davos, or perhaps, you know, maybe in the temple in Israel, who knows, you know, you could, maybe it's in the Vatican, you know, mm-hmm. maybe it's in China. I don't know. Anyway, I think that it's much more organic, small groups of people kind of doing these things willy-nilly, some of them directing it very intentionally. But none of it is like universal. But one way or the other, whether it's fully intentional, mm-hmm. whether, as I kind of see it, you have very much an intelligence drawing us in this direction, but it's just not one that you could look at and touch with your hands. But one way or the other, you are seeing entire bloodlines being severed, along with the cultural transmission, bloodlines being severed, no more passing down of your blood to the next generation, instead wasted away on video games and mm-hmm. drugs. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a use for people in the future to work, if you don't have any value in them, you know, what are they going to do? Sit around and like whittle sticks, mm-hmm. you know, swim in the ocean. If the ocean gets too full, it's not going to be too fun, right? No, you need to find ways to keep them pacified, keep them inside, keep them under lockdown like COVID, mm-hmm. kind of good practice. Yeah. One. So, that's
what pay them to stay home.
Yeah. And that's what I see. That I see people who are non-competitive are going to have more and more, escapes, right? Like, mm-hmm. More and more outlets for their natural human ambition and desire, that have absolutely no impact whatsoever on the real world. And they will just slowly fade away and disappear. Their bloodline will. Mm-hmm. Then the soul will go on, in at least my own view.
But shared by everybody at this table.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but
and most of the people watching this show.
Yeah.
Yes, but as far as this world is concerned, as far as this world order, that's a process that we're undergoing right now, and it's tragic. It's horrible.
And to numb people so that, I mean, obviously we were created by God. This is my belief, to have a relationship with God. That's why he put Adam in the garden and he walked with him in the cool of the day. And this seems like it's numbing down, and numbing down so that there really isn't a relationship.
Yes.
The whole purpose of why we were actually here.
Yes. You know what that actually brings to mind? I don't mean to divert the conversation or digress too much, but, you know, we're speaking about virtual church, mm-hmm. right? Something that really bothers me about the entire digitization process of religion is that rather than the seeking to commune with something that you can't see with your physical eyes, maybe you have an image of Jesus that allows you to pray in a way that it grips you more readily because of that visceral contact. But ultimately what it's doing is it's stimulating your heart, your mind, and then the soul within that to commune with another soul that is unseen by and large, and yet the presence felt. It's a sign pointing you in the direction of something. It's not the thing. Mm-hmm. The more realistic you make it, this is like one of the big reasons behind the schism, right, between the Orthodox and the Catholics. The more realistic it is, the more that thing is seen as the entity towards which your soul is to be directed. And so if you end up with something like Christ GPT, so I have a question for Jesus. It exists, by the way.
Oh, that exists?
They don't call it Christ GPT. That's my coinage. But it does. There are various apps, actually. You just it's easy. It's the easiest pie. You do nothing but take a large language model, or a language model, even a minor, and train it on the words of Jesus, and it spits out. In fact, one of the more famous instances was Boosted. I don't remember the name of the app itself. Maybe Colton could tell us, but that Fox News did a booster article on this, an app that allows you to speak to Jesus and allows you to speak to Satan, Basically, it was trained on Jesus. It's been tinkered with a little bit because Jesus has fairly liberal views on marriage arrangements in this case. But you're asking Jesus directly. Now,
That's so scary.
That Fox News boosted it doesn't surprise me at all, because Fox is
controversial. New AI app allows you to text with Jesus and Satan.
Yeah. I mean, that is so scary. It's like, then why have a relationship with God?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh yeah, Kurt, the cyber guy, nuts, and I hope him and Jordan Peterson spoon at night. I shouldn't diss Jordan Peterson so much. His accomplishments in early life were phenomenal. Something about that post-Xanax, post-Daily Wire Jordan Peterson irks me so much, though, that I just can't even look back.
He's brought some great conversations to the table and got people thinking and created some dialogues that didn't ever, exist outside this. This idea, though, of a distraction from deity.
Yes.
To replace it. Like, it's very, here, you talk to this magic eight ball or this cup or anything else, but it's a distraction from
So they're talking about AI rewriting the Bible. So that I've heard that a few times. And so I'm like, okay, this is really interesting, because it wouldn't take much, because, when I'm in church we were even in a pastor's meeting with pastors from all over the world. They were together. Not one physical Bible. All of them pulled out their phone.
Yeah.
And I thought, how easy would it be for them to just rewrite, just tweak here, tweak there, change the message here, there?
Absolutely.
Maybe a pastor may recognize it, but most people wouldn't have any idea. A little tweak here, a little tweak there.
Thou should not. It's a big difference.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because, you even look at, 2020 hit. Look, nobody had a dictionary anymore. Yes. How easy was it for them to change words? I mean, it didn't.
Mother.
Yeah, exactly.
Mother, vaccination,
immunity. Yeah.
Recession.
It was like this, tweak here, tweak there, and most people don't have a physical Bible anymore. Most people, they may have one at home, but they're not pulling it out. They're just pulling out their app on their phone.
This would be a good time to mention my friend Artie Antola, who founded Canonic XYZ or Canonic.xyz. They publish books. They carry mine, and this is kind of partly a plug, but it's not like a big company.
Hey,
don't worry.
Have at it.
But what they do is they do both digital and physical copies. Mine has both, but because it's done on the blockchain, they only sell in Bitcoin. The goal that Artie Antola had going into this is to teach conservative people how to use Bitcoin. He's not making a bank on this. Mm-hmm. He's not like a Bitcoin salesman. But he sees cryptocurrency and Bitcoin in particular, because of its redundancy, its widespread use, anyway, he sees Bitcoin as being something that's outside of the normal levers of control of digital currency. And insofar as information integrity, they publish the book on the blockchain digitally so that it can't be tampered with afterwards. If you tamper with a blockchain-based piece of information, any tampering can be seen. And so there's a hash that allows you to identify the moment it was published, and anything that happens to it after that is exposed. It's transparent to the network.
Wow.
So Canonic XYZ is publishing these books in the hopes that if things really go bad, that you will have, even in digital form, beyond the physical, in digital form that's easily replicated all over the place, something that has inherent integrity. If I could go into one...
Can you spell it and make sure that we'll put the link to that down below this recording on all platforms? Yeah. But
spell it so we know.
Make sure that for people just listening on audio or something else that they can find that.
Canonic, C A N O N I C. Canonic. I don't know why I've always had trouble. You're like the fifth person to ask me that. I should be in good practice by now. But Canonic, C A N. O-N-I-C.
Like canonized.
Kind X-Y-Z. Of. Yes. Yeah. And that's, Ardian is Orthodox. And
there
they
have it.
C-A-N-O-N, so canon.
Yep. Canonic XYZ. Mm-hmm. And it's XYZ. The website is canonic.xyz.
And you can find Darkian on there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I encourage you to buy it. But I also, there's a lot of, there's going to be a lot of PC works in there, but Tola is, like I say, he is he's Orthodox, and he's his
25 Satoshis.
Yeah, you can get it on discount, but you can only buy it in Bitcoin. You can only buy in Bitcoin. He's obviously, if he wanted to make a million, he wouldn't do that.
Sure.
The point is to teach people how to use Bitcoin, because for him, he's been working me for like a year and a half to get me to even just consider doing anything like this, because I don't like the aesthetic of digital currency. Is a creepy thing.
Sure.
But as we move into a period where these sorts of things become what they become, yep. it's sort of like basically a good analogy would be having a year 2000 car that didn't have – it's not a smartphone on wheels mm-hmm. in a world of autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. It's still a car. It's still technology. But there's a bit more self-determination involved.
Yeah. Makes sense.
If I could jump off, you know, the rewriting the Bible. Mm-hmm. So that's been happening for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. From the Greek on, right? Like that's been happening for a long time. But if I could use this for an illustration, since we're talking about a Harari, and eventually, so Harari doesn't pay me to defend him. But eventually the first thing I'm going to do is hit that dude up for some Skrill for all the defending I do of him. Cause I, like I say, I don't agree with his philosophy by and large, at least not his atheism, certainly not his philosophy on free will. But I do think that having, you know, I was covering Harari on Steve's show before he became widely known among populists. And the way it was known is me and Steve is going to have to own it. Me and Steve, when trying to introduce our audience to introductory books on transhumanism, the three big ones, Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark, Team Human by Douglas Rushkoff.
Okay.
And also The Singularity is Near by Ray Kurzweil, and Homo Deus by Yuval mm-hmm. Noah Harari.
Okay.
And the reason being is because he does a very good job of articulating it. So I'm going to defend him one last time. And if nothing else, just defend the integrity of what he's saying, even if I disagree completely with the philosophy of it. That idea, you've probably seen the headline, World Economic Forum wants to rewrite the Bible. It made it its way everywhere. I'm not going to name names, but Slay News was the first one to put it out. And,
I'm not going to name names.
And they cook up this headline, World Economic Forum wants to rewrite AI to rewrite the mm-hmm. Bible, right? So that all comes from, and here you have Klaus Schwab, Yuval Harari, Klaus Schwab's lead advisor. I've never heard that anywhere except for in the critics. There's this whole culture of BS around this that is just so galling. I can't, you know, I will not smash anything here, but if I talk about too much, I'll hammer my fist on the table. But so where does it come from? It comes from a talk.
Well, you already defended Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Oh!
Already, so
just the ideas, not the tactics.
so we set a precedent right out of the gate.
Yeah. Although Ted was a very insightful man, despite his
that's
psychosis.
Why you're on that side of the table and we're on this side of the table.
Legal liability ends right here.
What do they say sometimes? The views of the show don't necessarily represent those of Flyover Conservatives.
Exactly. Neither
yes, credit. Yes, yes. Okay, yeah.
Or Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
But I do have that book by Ted Kaczynski, and because it's been referenced so many times, because the ideas are phenomenal.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with Joe Allen.
When you see that the dollar is worth less, literally every single month, and for the first time in our life, the 80-year run of the dollar being the supreme thing around the world is going away. This is not going to be artificially propped up much longer because it's not respected around the world.
And so some of our friends may think we're crazy. We talk about silver right now, buying silver, buying silver, buying silver. And they're like, what are you talking about? Why not the stock market? What is your problem? What are you thinking? It's kind of like that 2008, 2009 time period. It's like, I think in a very yep. short period of time, there's going to be a lot of people that wished they would have bought silver.
I know that Dr. Kirk Elliott is the number one best person to trust and to take care of you in this situation.
That is exactly right. If you want to set up a free consultation with Dr. Kirk Elliott, you just go to flyovergold.com. When you scroll down to the bottom, there's a place you can fill out your information. When you do that, someone from Dr. Kirk's team will get a hold of you, help answer questions for you. It's a free consultation. It doesn't cost you any money whatsoever. Or you can call 720-605-3900. Do it today. You will be glad you did.
That comes from an interview, actually, that Harari had given where he was talking about the uniqueness of artificial intelligence as opposed to other technologies. And one of them was that it can make decisions. So mm-hmm. we've always had nuclear weapons. We've had nuclear weapons since the 40s. And yet those systems were reliant on human beings to push the red button. With artificial intelligence, it is capable of making its decisions. You can train an AI and turn it loose, and it, according to kind of to its own lights, it can make the decision to kill or not to kill. That's unique.
Yeah.
But maybe more importantly, he talked about the printing press. AI can make decisions about what it's going to teach you. So, you know, the printing press had an enormous impact on Western civilization and eventually the world. But whatever you put into the printer came out the other end minus any mistakes. And it just did what it was supposed to do.
Right.
It was a mechanism. It was a machine. AI, on the other hand, you train GPT on the world corpus, and it comes out with kind of what it wants to tell you. Yes, they put guardrails on it to make it more woke. Yes, they do all this stuff, but it tells you what it wants to tell you. It is edging towards a non-human intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. So what Harari was talking about then, he was talking about that religions the world over have always posited that their holy books come from a non-human intelligence. But each religion believes that their book comes from a non-human intelligence, whereas the other books were just written by humans. So that if you are, a devout Jew, then, you know, the Torah comes from God, whereas the New Testament is, you know, perhaps inspired, but that's the work of man. And certainly Buddhist Tripitaka or something like that is that's just people coming up with things, you know. So, so what his argument was, what Harari's argument was that none of these, you know, are non-human intelligences. Humans have always just made up their holy books. But soon, with the advent of AI, and especially religions surrounding these AIs, that they will claim a non-human intelligence wrote their holy book, and it will be correct. They will be correct.
Mm.
And somehow these guys at Slay News twisted that into Yuval Harari, who's somehow supposed to be like this like lead advisor and World Economic Forum representative, says that AI will rewrite the Bible so that it is correct. And this is the sort of thing that will be used to justify human beings not being able to be stewards of our own information systems, because humans are very flawed. They're very prone to twisting words or making things up. And humans are very prone to believing things that have been fed to them.
Yeah.
And so this is an argument, by the way, that's being made all the time, even by, to some extent, people like Harari, that, you know, our sense of free will is an illusion, and the decisions we make are pretty much just the end result of all these different cognitive biases that drive us to do this or to do that. And because we don't have real free will anyway, and because we're flawed by our biases, the only real way forward to progress as human beings is going to be to have some kind of human AI symbiosis, because AI is potentially objective. AI is potentially an arbiter between our biases in the world, and so that the superior human being will be one in which this AI kind of sits like a tertiary brain, maybe physically, but more than likely just kind of abstractly, helping us make our decisions, or even making our decisions for us and making better decisions for us than we
would
ourselves.
Like your mapping software.
Exactly like that.
You know,
rerouting.
If I were to grab 10 people at the mall and ask them privately, you know, who was Kyle Rittenhouse? What is he about? I can get huge swings in what he was about and even what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who died that day.
And who died and what color their skin and everything else and his motives and his heart are going to come. So, you know, an AI generated news service in this view, I mean, boy, we eliminate all that.
Yeah.
Because you got one true news feed that doesn't have this CNN, Fox vibe. It's just the truth.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to listen to.
You know, Musk wanted to initially call his, it would have been such a terrible name, but Truth GPT.
Ooh.
So that would do exactly that. Truth GPT. That sounds, no insult to the social media platform, but it sounds tacky. But
yeah.
But that was the goal. And that is the goal currently with XAI. XAI, the goal is to create an AI that's just curious about the universe. It's based, right? It's not PC. And you can get, It basically, if you think about AI as being a kind of it's just condensing information, right? Mm-hmm. It's a compression software, and it's just compressing information to give it to you. And if you train it properly on the proper data, it's just going to compress the truth for you. So Jordan Peterson, and
you can't help yourself.
Yeah, you can't.
You got me.
You're like
you
somebody keeps going back to the same girl that breaks his heart over
you
and over
again. Got me going, you know. Well, I never loved the guy, but I thought he was pretty cool at first.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, this, like I say, this whole
you are crazy about him. you would talk about somebody so much.
This whole yeah, you're right. This is the last time he comes up. but if you know, one day you'll see me skipping down a beach with Ferrari in one hand and Peterson in the other,
dressed like Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't
bigger beard.
I didn't say where we were going or what I was going to do with them. But but Peterson, you know, when he was talking, and also Hans Monk from Epoch Times, what he was talking about during that interview, right, or the discussion in Canada, and Hans Monk soon after him, they were talking about GPT before the woke guardrails. And what's really interesting about the what happened there is that, you know, the initial run, people like Peterson got to see it early. People like Hans Monk got on it early, and they saw it as something that was not PC. It was actually like quite balanced. And Hans Monk during his Epoch Times report, this was around must have been early December.
Okay.
Because it came out late November. And he was talking about how balanced it was. He said he envisioned it as being a way of getting beyond the woke biases of Wikipedia and the woke biases of Google. And the example he used, he asked GPT to explain the Hunter Biden laptop scandal. Mm. And he said it gave him an extraordinarily balanced view. Like, these people say this, these people say that. But he was like, this is going to be a way to get beyond that, like you say, that Fox News, MSNBC bias. Of course, they just put woke guardrails around it, and then that was that.
Right.
And that's what Musk is seeking to correct. But again, like, what's the source of authority in life, right? Like, you know, you hope that you have wise people in your life, and so it's the people in your life. And then you hope that you're intelligent, and maybe you'll come up in your twisted little peanut, or my twisted little peanut, you're probably right. your mind might come up with some nuggets of wisdom. And then, of course, you know, for those who turn to it or are fortunate enough to receive it, receive wisdom from God. In a godless world, which is predominantly the world, certainly Elon Musk or Sam Altman or people like that.
Harari.
You know, and Harari, absolutely. In a godless world, what is inevitable is that the flawed humans in your life will be the primary mode until you've created a technology that is superior to, or at least a human who is not augmented by that technology is going to be lesser than, is going to be, inferior. And so what we're talking about is shifting authority away from ancient tradition, away from the community, away from human experts, and towards the machine, so that the machine itself becomes this cultural icon, this source of truth, the truth GPT. And you might say, well, okay, that's the machine as an entity. And to some extent, with artificial intelligence, that's true. But it's also the machine being deployed by the human beings who are going to benefit from it. And you can see it with that woke shift in GPT, exactly how this is going to play out, or at least in the early phase.
So, okay, so what made you decide to write this book? And what are you hoping that people get from it?
And make sure we share with everybody how they can get it.
Yes, yes.
Well, I feel I've failed. Now that people have started reading it, people tell me that it scares them. Mm. And that's actually not my intention at all. I mean, if you didn't know about it, you should probably be unnerved.
Because you don't come across fearful.
No, you don't seem fearful at all. In fact, you were kind of upset at Jordan Peterson when he...
Who?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You seemed upset at him at his response.
Yeah.
So what are you hoping that they would gain, and why are you surprised that they're...
The first thing I hope is that it does at least make them aware of the intended revolution that we are now undergoing. Mm-hmm. And I hope that my perspective on this is not that it's engineered by any one central source, that it's a revolution that is so widespread that it's just simply, it's kind of coming, it's erupting. If there's any one engineer, again, invisible and perhaps even more intelligent than GPT.
There you go.
Yeah.
Which is a scary thought. I want them to understand that we are in the middle of that civilizational transformation that's happening. Mm-hmm. And now, having that awareness, I hope that to map out the technologies themselves and give them a sense of what these technologies are going to mean for human life in the very near future, and of course in the distant future, should we all make it. But the maybe the most important thing I hope that readers take away is that this is not purely technological and sociological and economic. This is spiritual. This is religious. Mm-hmm. And one part of it is my own religious point of view, or at least the point of view of Western, you know, Christian tradition of these technologies. But also that the people creating these technologies, including the atheists, that for them it's spiritual. For them it's religious. For the atheists, it is not the fulfillment of some spiritual plan. It is the creation of the spiritual. It's the creation of the gods. It's the creation of heaven and hell, something that they didn't believe existed before. And that is going to be the in many ways, these technologies for them, it's the realization or the fruition of all these not true religions.
Interesting.
And so I hope that the reader will get a sense by the end of the book, if it scared them, my hope is that they will be so desensitized that they will begin to think rationally and begin to formulate a kind of an alternative worldview. Because like what this book is, I'm channeling all these different narratives. Of course, I add a few jokes here and there, and of course, I add some of my own opinion. But by and large, I just try to channel, to organize and channel other voices. And so that you can see how these worldviews bubble up. But I hope, some are not going to do that, but I hope people realize those are not their stories. Those stories stand either apart from their own internal mythos, their own stories, or in direct opposition to their own stories. And my hope is that people are strengthened in their own grounding in the spirit and in this world and in their families and in other people, and realize that this disruption is not, it's not just gadgetry. I mean, this is an entire constellation of ideologies, and perhaps an entire constellation as in powers and principalities that are moving through these gadgets. And I don't want them to go Uncle Ted by any means. by any means, like zero chance whatsoever that that's the way to do it. And it really isn't, because you see what happened with Ted. He just became a justification for increased surveillance, increased security, and justification for more and more kind of ridicule of anti-tech sentiments. But just as people make the decisions, like how much of this do I incorporate? How much of myself do I offload to the machine? I hope they can do so with clear eyes.
That is great. And so where's the best place for them to find your book?
You know, if you're Bitcoin savvy, canonic.xyz, don't make me misspell. I screw it up.
You got that and got the link below, your website as well.
There are links on my website, but it maybe go directly to the publisher, skyhorsepublishing.com, or you can also get it at Barnes & Noble. You can also get it at my favorite, bookshop.org. They're lefties. But they've not censored anyone that I know of, and they're very responsive if they screw up. Or if your listeners are conditioned to the Amazon beast with their palm payment system and their ubiquitous surveillance and their founder who wants to put trillions of people in space and come visit Earth every now and then as if it were a national park, with their bizarre phallic smile logo, if your listeners are conditioned to Amazon, it's available at Amazon. Please give it a good rating. But I do think that it's important to support people like bookshop.org and, of course, Canonic.
Very cool.
Joe, thank you for taking the time to be here. I know you're going to do a live event for us, you know, as well, and a Q&A. And you're very generous with your time and energy and passionate about these topics. And I'm just really thankful. Thankful that you're out there kind of bringing some clarity to this. In the way that you're doing.
And how can they, before we let you go, how can they follow your tour? Because you know, you're going to be different places. Is there any way that they can follow that? And if you're going to be in their area, that they would know?
Yeah, my website, joebot.xyz. I'll be, next stops are, I don't know when this airs, but next stops will be in Dallas, in L.A., and Tulare, California, where I'll be rejoining you.
Yes.
Yep, on the Reawaken Tour. Yep.
Then I probably have something set up at AmFest in Phoenix. And then after that, Look for me in, I had a little rhyme for it. It was Miami and Austin, New York and Boston. Those are my next ones in January.
Okay. Sounds like a good base for a song. So.
It does.
Yeah, that I'll sounds be a rapper good. Before you know it.
And they can always catch you on Steve Bannon's War Room.
And you can find me on Steve Bannon's War Room. You know, if I can say one good, give Bannon a bit of credit here. He basically took a person who was kind of meandering around, and he forced me to focus all of my energy in one direction. Mm-hmm. And if there's one idea that I really took from Steve, is the idea that this has to be about duty and not about anything else. Mm-hmm. This is something in a duty. It doesn't matter if it feels good. You just do your duty. It doesn't matter if it's lucrative. It doesn't matter if it gets you in big trouble. You simply do your duty no matter what. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, in regard to, like, why wouldn't I let my kid sink into an iPad? If I'm that kid, why wouldn't I sink into an iPad mm-hmm. or VR or my Neuralinked alternate reality should such technologies come online? It's not because it feels good in the real world. It's not because all of this toil and all the interpersonal mm-hmm. Strife is pleasurable. It's because your duty is here. And I think that is, to me anyway, mm-hmm. the only real rational answer to why you should reject these sorts of things.
And you were generous enough to let him write the foreword to your book.
Yes. Yes.
Which I thought was just a nice plug to kind of keep his career moving forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Down you know, the field as well.
He's, you know, if there's one thing that's absolutely sure, Steve Bannon is riding my coattails on this one.
Yeah, he's drafting off you, but you know.
Joe Allen, who? Which one? Yeah. Which one?
Joe, thanks so much
thank
for stopping
so
by the
much.
Flyover Podcast. Time. Thank you so much.
Thank
you very
appreciate
much.
It, Joe.
And thank you, Flyover family, for joining us for this conversation. We hope you're enjoying these conversations where we get a chance to
deep dive.
Take a little more time and you're not
They're
as
so
rushed.
Much fun. I love them.
People enjoy them while you're mowing the grass or on a hike or all the things that you're doing. If you enjoyed it, please ask you to give it a like and share it with somebody that came to mind. That's how we get this message out and kind of make a difference to the communities and the people that you're involved with.
That's exactly right. And if you're watching us on Rumble, we just ask that you would follow us there. We're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers by January. We are getting so close and we really appreciate your help. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We bless you. We bless you to realize you were born for such a time as this. We bless you to realize your future is brighter than your past. Yes. And we bless you to wake up, speak up, and show up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Flyover Conservatives podcast with David and Stacey Whited. Please subscribe, hit the notification bell, and leave us a comment below. Lastly, if you enjoyed today's podcast, share with those who came to mind. Be blessed and make it a great day.